when I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about tonight, I was out on a walk before I came here, and a quote that is not really a particular famous quote, it's a quote that I heard a colleague of mine say in a room full of people, and it just stuck in my mind. And this was someone who shared the Dharma as well, and he said, "I try to teach from my mistakes." And I thought, oh, I aspire to that. It really moved me. I recently, this is just coming to mind, I was also so moved recently, I don't know where I heard this, but someone was talking about teaching. I don't think that it was teaching, I think it was a professor was talking about teaching and said that I measure my success by my students' capacity to surpass me, you know? And I think like both of those things have the same flavor of just like laying it all out there and offering yourself up. So tonight what came up to talk about and discuss with you all is afflictive mind states, which I've been going through for the last week. They're so core to the heart of what this practice is useful for, or what it better be useful for. I heard this quote from the Dalai Lama. I wasn't there. I can't prove that he said it, but I was told that he was at Emory, which is a college, and he was visiting there teaching, and someone asked him, what is the most important thing in life? Which is a hell of a question, but it's the kind of question that the Dalai Lama gets asked, of course. Compassion for that guy who's constantly getting asked questions like that. Don't ask me any questions like that. Please feel free to come on in. Don't feel disruptive. But what his answer was, I thought, there was another thing that really stuck out in my mind. He said, well, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, it's just from the top of my head, you know, well, if you're a business person, then I guess, you know, the most important thing in life is to earn money and grow your business. And if you're an artist, then the most important thing in life is to offer yourself to your art. And then he said, if you're a meditator, I think it's learning how to work with difficult emotions. And that's a pretty strong statement of, I mean, the Dharma is vast. For those of us in the room, and I see many who have been practicing and committed and learning and studying for a long time, there's a lot in the teachings. And so for him to single out working with afflictive mind states or difficult emotions as the most important thing is a pretty powerful thing to say. So, I have a clock somewhere. Can someone else see the clock? That's what I need. I'm going to attempt to not talk for too long, but I tend to just talk. So there's a few things that, ways that I work with difficult mind states that I'll share with you. I think one of the things that we need in working with difficult mind states is a bit of a toolkit, because sometimes the right, sometimes what we try to do is actually motivated by the aversive mind or the wanting the difficult mind state to just go away. It's not motivated by wisdom. Yeah. And often when the motivation is not one of wisdom, when we're working with a difficult mind state, it just doesn't help. Often makes it worse or squashes it and represses it in some way so that it's internalized in the body in an unhealthy way or ekes out through our actions in unexpected and problematic ways. So I'll offer a few different suggestions that you know, maybe you can use as a toolkit. I think of working with difficult emotions really at three kind of different levels. And one is working at the level of the mind, working at the level of thinking. Yeah? For me, one of the most powerful tools at this level has been a practice of forgiveness. Is using thought to orient the heart towards acknowledging what is causing an afflictive mind state. So anger comes up, we're aggrieved in some way, yeah? Or even loss can come up, and we're angry at the world. Yeah? And forgiveness, I use it as a practice and use it with phrases. I think that the practice is attributed to Jack Kornfield, who adapted an ancient tradition in the Theravada monastic lineage called Pawarna. And Pawarna's where the community of monastics get together and ask for forgiveness from each other. This helps, ideally, to ameliorate the tensions of just brushing shoulders with each other all the time, you know? Monastics are pretty human, too, if you couldn't guess. Huh? And so the Buddha offered this ritual of sorts within the community of forgiveness. And because that practice is one that is done in the monastic community, often when we run into teachings for lay people, we don't hear a lot about that. I think the only other time that forgiveness is mentioned in the classical teachings is when the Buddha said there are like two, I won't get the superlatives right, but two like wondrous and rare beings, something like that. And one is a being who has the capacity to forgive, who's a forgiving being. And yet for me, this has been an essential way, even if they're not often taught in lay meditation circles. Forgiveness has been an essential way for me to work with afflictive mind states. And when I teach, some of you are in my 5-week intro to, what is it called? Way of Awareness class, Intro to Insight Meditation. And in that class, I give, as part of the weekly homework, each night as you go to bed, to just think of one thing that you can offer forgiveness for from that day. And just as the Buddha intended it to operate in the community to diffuse the tensions that brush that happen from brushing up against each other in a community, for me, when I'm undertaking this practice, it helps to ameliorate the residual buildup of frustration or resentment or anger or another way that I think about it's interesting that really all this kind of classical teaching stuff is coming to mind right now. Another way that I think about this is coming to me in the moment. It just relates to the way that I think about working at the level of the mind. Is the Buddha often or there are many suttas where the Buddha talks about gratification, danger, and escape. It sounds like it's some kind of like a thrilling novel. Gratification, danger, and escape. He's talking about our enchantment with the world, the kind of being caught up in the world that is the fundamental cause for us to get really worked up, you know, to when we're really attached to the outcome of something, it doesn't go the way we want, yeah, then we get threatened or frustrated, or that's the soil for difficult emotions to arise. And through this kind of enchantment, we get caught up in the gratification of potential getting what we want, and positive, pleasant mind states and bodily sensations. Yeah, and he talks about the danger of this being that, well, fundamentally, these things can't provide any kind of lasting fulfillment. And so we get caught up in them, and then we're in for it. So then that's danger. This is the danger inherent in that which has the possibility to gratify. The gratification is saying, like, yes, getting what you want is pleasant, and that enchants the mind. And the danger there is that ultimately these things don't have the capacity to fulfill us. And the escape is the possibility through the practice, through intimacy with understanding this way that we get caught up, we can actually release it before it starts with wisdom. Yeah, this is escape, not actually running away from the possibility of getting caught up, but understanding through intimacy. So for me, this relates so closely to difficult mind states, because we can tend to fuel them. There is some subtle kind of gratification that often comes through mind states that we would rather not have if someone asked us. Yeah, we can wallow in sadness, or we can brew with anger. Huh? If you stopped me on the street a couple times this week, you could have caught me brewing in anger. This is what I mean from teaching from my mistakes. It's like, this is up for me. This is the wisdom that I need to hear right now. And so seeing this gratification and understanding that even this mind state won't last. Yeah. There might be gratification in saying that angry thing. Yeah. And then when we're not angry, how are we gonna feel about that? Not great. So there's a kind of escape in relinquishing the belief in our own mind state that is caught up in its own anger, caught up in its own sadness, its own self-hatred, its own fearful doubt. Yeah. The next kind of level of working with difficult emotions that I was thinking about was working with them at the level of wisdom, and at the level of insight, or the lack of insight. So often, when I'm in a mood, it might be annoyed with somebody. I can think of situations at work. Yeah. Well, any kind of emotional state, actually pleasant or unpleasant, when there isn't mindfulness present, when we're not aware that we're in a mood of some kind, there's this subtle belief, the magical thinking that's going on is it's as if we're always going to feel this way. We start like planning the rest of our life as if we're going to feel that same emotion. So we're like elated and we're like, next year I'm going to, you know, I'm going to travel to where, whatever it is, you know? And when we're angry, it's like, oh yeah, like tomorrow I'm going to do this and that and this and that. And it's like, tomorrow, who knows how you're going to feel? Yeah? And yet that wisdom is so obvious that these emotions and mindsets come and go, and yet it's so easy to somehow extend our emotional experience forward and backwards in time. We also see the past through an angry lens. You know, there's a teacher I love who, I almost want to say he like grew up here, George Mumford, who many of you probably know. He was a resident here for a long time, and he talks about having hate glasses or having love glasses. And when you're hating, you put on hate glasses and you see the world through that lens. Yeah. When you're loving, you put on love glasses and you see the world through that lens. And because time is all in the mind, folks, because the future just is a thought and the past is just a thought, our emotions color every thought that comes into the mind. And so all of the future will be affected and all of the past will be affected. And it's just the conditioning of what's happening in the present moment. Yeah? So we forget this. This is misunderstanding the fundamental truth or the fundamental characteristic of impermanence. Yeah? That this mind state is going to come, is going to go. Another thing that we miss at the wisdom level is that we often identify with our emotional states. Yeah? We say something like, I am hurt, yeah, or like, I am furious, or I'm delighted. Yeah? And there's just a kind of subtle identification, a way in which we often can believe that we are our emotions. And especially with afflictive mind states, you know, I can see that when I'm identified with my own emotions and I perceive that someone hurts my feelings, well, if my feelings are me and those feelings are hurt, then I'm fundamentally threatened. And my whole system, the body and the mind, physiologically goes into a like life-protecting mode. Yeah? It's like, okay, the organism is under attack, yeah? And we're in fight or flight. Given any perception that some object out there can afflict our emotional state. Yeah? And if we see that our emotions are not who we are, then we're not existentially threatened in this way by that which can condition struggle, hatred, mild annoyance in the mind. I'm just thinking if there's anything else I want to say about that. Sometimes it's really hard to not be identified with our emotions when they're coming up. One thing that helps, the kind of the way that it shows up in the classical teachings when the Buddha's pointing, trying to prod the bhikkhus, the practitioners, into seeing that something is not to be identified with. One of the questions is that which arises and passes actually stable and satisfying? If it's not stable and satisfying and it's transitory, is it worthy of being identified with as the core of who you are? Yeah? So a kind of a simpler way to do that in the moment of having an afflicted mind state is actually back to that first thing I mentioned, is recognizing that it's going to come and go. Oh, this is going to come and go. I'm bigger than this. Yeah. And then we don't end up feeling deeply threatened, which causes us to be reactive, yeah, and then to create the conditions for more things that are going to condition afflictive emotions. Whoo, boy, we get into it. I do. Good Lord. And the last of these, working at the wisdom level, is not seeing afflictive mind states as actually suffering, and not believing that it's okay. This is actually the real one, is not believing that it's okay for there to be dissatisfaction, suffering. We think that it's like fundamentally wrong on some level. Yeah, you feel bad, and it's like the core attitude in the mind, in my mind at least, is it shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't feel this way. Yeah, when we're not paying attention, this is the fundamental reaction that shows up. It shouldn't be like this. And all that's happening here, as practitioners of the Dhamma, we're just forgetting the first noble truth. Whoops. Yeah. Like, dissatisfactoriness abounds. You are guaranteed to get that which you don't want. And you're guaranteed to not get that which you want. Yeah? It's going to happen. It's guaranteed. And when we remember this truth, even when the mind is in pain, we can feel at peace and at harmony with life. Oh, this is not wrong. This is just the human condition. That changes everything. And it doesn't take away our anger or our grief or our sadness or our self-judgment, but it's as if it's like held and nurtured in wise understanding. Yeah. Well, this is the human condition. That often leads me to think, oh, how many people on earth are feeling this way right now? Often we feel so lonely. We're caught up in our story and the particularities of how we became aggrieved. And it feels quite lonely, and yet we've got plenty of company. Feeling sad? There's a lot of folks out there in the world right now feeling just that way. Yeah, this is the human condition. The last is that I think about and ways to work with difficult mind states is at the level of awareness itself, this capacity of life for there to be knowing, wakeful consciousness, that in every moment, whether we're mindful or not, something is being known effortlessly, that life is illuminated. Yeah? For me, I see this miraculous aspect of our human experience as one of the most beautiful things in nature. Yeah? Just that no matter what my preference is, there is going to be a perfect knowing of something in every moment. I'm breathing and knowing it. I'm sitting and knowing it. I'm scared and knowing it. Yeah? And awareness itself has perfect intimacy with every experience. Yeah? When someone pinches us, yeah? Awareness doesn't know half a second later or a quarter of a second later. Yeah? It's right there. There's an immediacy to life in each moment. When we're present, there's a real direct immediacy. This is just awareness being natural. And I actually, the way that I relate to this is in an afflictive mind state, I look to this aspect of nature as inspiration. The mind, for me, can become inspired towards developing the qualities that awareness has of itself effortlessly. This perfect intimacy, this not preferencing and wanting one experience over another. Yeah, awareness doesn't abandon us when it's not being aware of something great, you know, like ice cream, and then like the next moment, you know, a bus drives by and water splashes us, and awareness is like, ah, screw it, I'm out of here. You know, we are in the midst of this deep fidelity to life that we can't control. When we're identified with the mind, we feel like our capacity to be with life comes and goes. We open and we close. But awareness itself is never abandoning life, ever, ever. And it's always available as a source of inspiration. And so, it's like it has all the qualities of the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings, in and of itself. And when the mind lacks this capacity, it can just look to awareness. When awareness touches suffering, it's right there. And it's letting all the suffering through, and it's right there. Yeah? And you can watch it. You can appreciate it as it's happening. I can sit there and be suffering and go, wow, awareness has no problem with this. None. And my mind actually gets inspired by that. The thinking, feeling mind can go, might I be so intimate, so preferenceless? Yeah, and it is a source of inspiration. Not to mention that it can be a balm just to rest in the knowing as opposed to the content, which is quite painful. And yet it's important not to abandon the conditions of life. Yeah. In my better moments, but not in every moment, I can remember that these conditions of life are not mine. They're the world's, just flowing through this moment, and that this being has the opportunity to help transform those conditions. It's as if like my short time on this earth is just being handed things that have the opportunity to be held in a way that transforms them for good. Yeah? My emotions are no different. I didn't ask for them. Yeah? They're conditioned by this world, and my capacity to meet them with wisdom and compassion changes the conditions in the world. Yeah. So that's just a few thoughts about three levels of working with afflictive emotions. At the level of thinking, the thinking, feeling mind, directly at the level of wisdom, which often cuts through into this broader space of wisdom, and at the level of awareness, which for me acts as an inspiration and inspiration in its capacity to nurture every condition that shows up in the mind, no matter what it is. I'd say, like, any time, this is the last thing I'll say, and then we'll start talking together. Any time as a practitioner that I relate to skillful means or a kind of toolkit kind of attitude, is really important to keep in mind why am I using what I'm using? Why am I going to try forgiveness, and why am I going to try not identifying with this emotion? You know, what's the motivation behind using the skillful means as a contemplative that I'm going to use? And I keep it simple and let the teachings inform me what might work and see if they do work. And you know, there's three wise intentions, the fundamental intentions that lead to non-suffering. And these are metta, goodwill, kindness, boundless friendliness, loving kindness. Nekama, renunciation, simplicity, letting go, relinquishing, and compassion. Now, specifically in the realm of afflictive mind states, between loving kindness and compassion, we're going to be on the compassion side of things because there's suffering there. As opposed to just feeling open-hearted, the open heart is meeting suffering and resonating with tenderness. So these are the motivation to act. So all of a sudden I'm aware. I'm aware that there is dejection in the mind. There is loneliness in the mind. There's bitterness in the mind. And awareness doesn't quite do it. Now I'm aware of it and I'm bitter. You know? Yeah. Okay. Walking down the street, aware and bitter. And so then there's the mind kicks into gear, and it's the mind of a practitioner. It's like, oh, what can I do? Maybe I'll try this, maybe I'll try that. And the question here is, what is the motivation? One of these being renunciation is the act of letting go, the move towards simplicity, letting go of that, specifically of that which does not serve. You know, this is, it reminds me of Joseph Goldstein often quotes a saying that from the teachings that I think is just really kind of striking and compelling. It says, anger with its poisoned source and honeyed tip. And it's really good to remember that there's a honeyed tip there, because that's what keeps us from letting it go. If we recognize that when there's anger in the mind, that it's just poisonous for the mind, yeah, we'd let it go. But we often spin it up, right? And the reason is because we don't recognize the honeyed tip. Yeah. And so, this motivation of letting go of mind states that are actually harmful, that are not wise to stew in. Yeah. This can be a motivation for reaching towards some sort of skillful means to work with experience directly. Yeah. And the other most likely between metta and compassion will be compassion, which compassion is the heart that meets suffering and cares about it. That seems so basic, but so often when we're hurting, we're like lost in the hurt, and we don't realize I'm hurting, and that matters to me, actually. You know, I care about this pain and this suffering. And compassion then moves one step farther and is motivated to alleviate the suffering. Might this suffering be alleviated? And there's actually a very subtle kind of, I don't want to say tension because it doesn't feel like tension and compassion, but it's this balance of being motivated to alleviate and yet witnessing that dissatisfaction, that suffering, that struggle is present. And this creates this feeling in the heart that, you know, we all know of a kind of poignancy when we're moved to alleviate some kind of suffering and we're witnessing that it's present. And this poignancy is actually wise. It is considered to be wise, a beneficial onward leading. It doesn't make us feel great all of a sudden, and yet when the mind is imbued with compassion, it is no longer afflicted by the emotion that or the thinking that is of the unskillful, painful mind state. Yeah. So it's a way that we can meet it directly and know that we're cultivating non-suffering through our orientation.